Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 184 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be focusing on something called the MBME Weird. For those that are listening to this podcast, consider this to be a continuation of episodes 37 and 97, like those popular risk factors, most common cause of death are podcasts. And in this podcast, really, the major thing I would focus on is like something that the MBME appears to be caring about these days, right? And I mean, lots of people have made Reddit posts on this and sent me emails about this, where you try to answer questions like, what's the most likely complication of disease, like in 2 years or in 1 year? Or what's the most likely outcome of disease? What's the most common cause of death? Or what is the most likely other finding on physical exam? Or what's the most likely clinical presentation of a disease? So I'll try to really focus hard on that here and then kind of take things from there. I'm going to work relatively quickly through this material. Okay, so what is the most common complication of a person having a history of like a cleft lip and palate? Well, that'll be chronic otitis media. Okay, that's the one you should watch out for in an exam, right? I mean, that will typically arise because the patient has some kind of eustachian tube dysfunction. If you don't see that as an answer choice, then consider going with like speech problems. Now, what is the most common complication that develops in a patient that receives a bone marrow transplant? Well, that'll be graft versus host disease. Now, what is the most common pregnancy-related complication of antiphospholipid antibody syndrome? Well, there'll be recurrent spontaneous abortions, right? And then what's the most likely complication that develops within the first 20 weeks of pregnancy? That's a spontaneous abortion, okay? Now, what is the most common cause of infection in burn patients? What is the most common cause of infection in burn patients? Well, that'll be sepsis, right, from Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Very high yield to know that for exams. Now, what is the most important intervention associated with decreasing the risk of ocular complications in a patient that has measles infection? Well, that will actually be given vitamin A, right? Remember, vitamin A will sort of helps with repairing the corneal epithelium. Now, what is the most common complication of like a person that has like a terminal disseminated malignancy? Well, that'll be cachexia, right? Remember, that classically arises because the person has like a catabolic state. And sometimes your friends at the MBME may ask you for like the mechanism behind this, right? You want to think about buzzwords like fat lipolysis, right? That's why those people tend to lose a ton of weight, or they break down like the myosin heavy chain, right? That's why they develop like muscle atrophy. And the appetite is classically suppressed, right? And remember that most of these things are mediated by TNF. Now, what is the most common, or I guess maybe most severe complication of a AAA? Like an abdominal aortic aneurysm. That's rupture, right? Okay. Now, what is the most common overall complication of chronic hypertension? What is the most common overall complication of chronic hypertension? That's left ventricular hypertrophy, right? Now, what is the most common cause of death in a patient with a history of chronic hypertension? That's an acute MI, okay? Now, what is the most common arrhythmia in a person that has a STEMI? That's a PVC, right? A premature ventricular contraction, okay? Now, what is the most serious complication what is the most serious complication of acute rheumatic fever? Well, that's some kind of carditis, right? Like myocarditis, endocarditis, blah, 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 right? And I guess, what is the most common cause of death in a patient with acute rheumatic fever? That'll be myocarditis. Okay. Now, what is the most common complication that develops in the first few hours of life in an infant of a diabetic mother? That'll be hypoglycemia, right? Remember, and they may ask you about the mechanism behind disease. Well, you want to be able to spot the fact that, right, the kid, because the kid is constantly exposed to like all these high glucose in utero, right, the kid undergoes like islet cell hyperplasia, right? So it makes a crap ton of insulin. So when the kid gets born, you know, they're still making that crap ton of insulin. So that will tank their blood glucose and that can cause a hypoglycemic seizures. Remember, hypocalcemia can also occur in an infant of a diabetic mother, but the most common you should think about is hypoglycemia. Okay. Now, what are three complications of oxygen therapy? I guess maybe two. Like prolonged oxygen therapy, like in a premature kid. Well, I hope you're thinking about like retinopathy of prematurity, bronchopulmonary dysplasia. Occasionally, you may see this finding a intraventricular hemorrhage, but to be honest, I don't really consider that to be a complication of oxygen therapy. Okay. Now, what is the most common cause of esophageal varices? Well, it's portal hypertension, right, from, you know, abusing alcohol chronically. Now, what is the most serious complication of Hirschsprung's disease? What is the most serious complication of Hirschsprung's disease? Well, this is actually death, right? Because the person can have like an enterocolitis from the bowel that's just super, super dilated. Now, what is the most common complication of Meckel's diverticulum? Well, that's bleeding, right? Now, what's the most common complication of diverticulosis, right? Think about like a painless lower GI bleed in the elderly, right? That's diverticulitis, right? So the most common complication of diverticulosis is diverticulitis, right? And again, your friends at the NBM may ask, what is the mechanism behind disease, right? It's actually like an impacted fecalith in the diverticulum sac, right? And then after that, you have like infection and inflammation kind of developing behind that fecalith. Now, what is the most serious complication of ulcerative colitis? Well, that's toxic megacolon. What's the most common complication of appendicitis? What is the most common complication of appendicitis? That's actually the development of a periappendiceal abscess. Now, what is the most common complication of cholelithiasis? Or I guess you can say biliary colic. Well, that's cholecystitis, right? That's a cholecystitis. Now, what's the most common complication of an upper urinary tract infection? What is the most common complication of an upper urinary tract infection? That's actually hydronephrosis, right? And it's actually kind of high yield to also know that the most common complication of retroperitoneal fibrosis is also hydronephrosis. Remember, retroperitoneal fibrosis is something you can find in IgG4-related diseases. Remember, IgG4-related diseases include things like autoimmune cholecystitis, autoimmune pancreatitis, and then they can also have like Riedel's thyroiditis, where they have like a painless Rocker thyroid. But these people can also have a retroperitoneal fibrosis. It's like a generalized fibrotic disease. Now, what is the most common complication of BPH? So benign prostatic hyperplasia, what's the most common complication? Well, that's obstructive uropathy. Okay. Now, what is the most likely outcome of actinic keratosis? It's actually just resolution of the disease, right? Very high yield to know for tests. Now, what is the most common complication of diabetes, especially like type 1 diabetes? That's actually insulin-induced hypoglycemia. Okay. Now, what is the most important mechanism, right? This is something your friends at the MME love. What's the most important mechanism? The underlying hyperglycemia in a patient with type 1 diabetes. That's gluconeogenesis, right? This is one of those nitpicky ways they introduce biochem, like light biochem into the exam. Now, what is the most serious complication of increased intracranial pressures? This one is easy, right? This herniation, that's obviously bad, right? Now, what is the most common cause of cyanide poisoning? So this is actually being in a house fire, right? Although remember, another cause you may see on an exam is a nitroprusside, like a lengthy nitroprusside infusion, right? But the most common cause of cyanide poisoning is actually being in a house fire. Now, what is the most common cause of fatty change in the liver? It's actually chronic alcoholism. They'll try to trick you into like saying, oh, the person is obese, that's why. That's not why, okay? The most common cause, very high yield of fatty change in the liver, is chronic alcoholism. Now, what is the most likely infectious complication of chronic granulomatous disease? That's pneumonia, right? Remember, CGD, X-linked recessive inheritance, NADPH oxidase deficiency. And you treat it with interferon gamma, right? Now, what is the most common cause of skin abscesses? Well, that's Staph aureus, right? Now, what's the most common cause of death in a patient with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome? That's actually aortic dissection. Okay, remember, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, it's autosomal dominant inheritance, usually arises from having mutations in type 1 and type 3 collagen. Now, what is the most likely barrier to the proper healing of a wound? So like, you're like, man, this wound doesn't seem to be getting better. That's actually persistent infection. Again, that's why I call this podcast the MBME Weird, right? I mean, again, if you're a med student, just look on Reddit, look on SDN, and see people complain about these kinds of questions. Now, what is the most common kind of rejection in a patient that gets a kidney transplant? Or you know what? Any transplant for that matter, really, this kind of applies to that. What is the most common kind of rejection? Well, that's going to be acute rejection, right? Remember, acute rejection, they may ask you about the mechanism. It can actually be a type 2 or in some cases a type 4 hypersensitivity reaction. Now, what is the most likely malignant complication of being on chronic immunosuppressive therapy? That's actually the development of like squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. Now, what is the most common cause of infection overall in a transplant recipient? That's CMV, right? Remember, it's not pronounced recipient. It's pronounced recipient. But anyhow, this is not an English class. Okay, so again, the most common cause of infection overall in a transplant recipient is CMV. Now, what is the most common cause of infection in a patient getting some kind of solid organ transplant? So like, let's say like a heart transplant, kidney transplant, lung transplant, pancreas transplant. That's actually candida, right? Now, what's the most common cause of infection in a patient getting a bone marrow transplant? That's actually aspergillus, right? That's why many of these bone marrow transplant patients, they get put on like voriconazole, for example, right? Number two on that list is candida, but just remember your A coming before your C. If you're a Laker fan, maybe Alex Caruso. That's a way to remember that the A comes first and then the C comes next. Now, what is the most likely organ to develop complications in a patient with lupus? That's actually the kidney, right? That's like diffuse proliferative glomerulonephritis. Now, what is the most common cardiac finding in a patient with lupus? That's actually fibrinous pericarditis, right? And then what's the most common cause of drug-induced lupus overall? That's procainamide, right? Don't forget your antihistone antibodies with that. Now, what is the most common cause of death in a patient with lupus? Well, that's infection from immunosuppression, right? Now, what is the most likely presenting complaint in a patient that is subsequently diagnosed with scleroderma? That's actually Raynaud's phenomenon, right? And remember, the skin is actually the most commonly involved organ in scleroderma. And then what's the most common cause of death in a patient with like systemic sclerosis, so like systemic scleroderma? That's actually respiratory failure, right? Remember, these people tend to develop a fibrotic lung disease. Now, what is the most common HIV serotype in the US? That's actually HIV-1. Okay. Now, what in a patient that presents with HIV in the US, what is the most likely mechanism of transmission? That's actually like men having sex with men. Okay. I mean, like a little over like 2/3 of cases of HIV in the US arise from men having sex with men. Now, what is the most likely etiology of HIV in a healthcare worker that, you know, just presents with HIV? Well, this will actually be from like an accidental needle stick exposure, right? Now, what is the most likely infectious complication in a HIV patient that has a CD4 count of 25? Now, think of one of two things on your exam. It can actually be like PCP pneumonia. And it can also be like, you know, like some kind of systemic candida infection. Now, what is the most common complication of systemic amyloidosis? That's renal failure, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you, you know, this patient came into the hospital 5 days ago. When the patient came in, it was 85 kilograms. Now, right now, the patient is 90 kilograms, right? And then they ask for the most likely mechanism behind the weight increase. What do you want to think about? But you want to think about increased total body sodium, right? Because remember, if you have an increase in your total body sodium, that will increase your blood volume, right? That will increase hydrostatic pressures in your bloodstream, right? And that will overall cause an increase in weight. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, presents with hyponatremia and increased urine osmolality? And then they ask, what is the most likely mechanism behind the lab finding? Right, so like hyponatremia, increased urine osmolarity. Well, you want to think about ectopic ADH production, right? You want to think about ectopic ADH production. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient on HCTZ? You know, he's on HCTZ for like, I don't know, like hypertension. And then this patient is found to have an EKG with a, like a prolonged QT interval and a U wave. And they say, what is the most likely clinical presentation of this patient to the healthcare system? Well, you want to think about muscle weakness and fatigue, right? This is primarily hypokalemia for the most part, right? Now, what's the most likely clinical complication of a left atrial thrombus? Well, this is actually like embolization, right? That can, you know, give rise to like organ ischemia or something like that. Now, what is the most serious complication of perineal cellulitis? That's actually neck fash, right? Now, what's the most common cause of death in a patient that is hospitalized in any ICU in the US. That would be septic shock, right? Now, in a boy with some kind of genetic mutation, what is the so this is a boy, right? So like, I'm essentially referring to like an X-linked recessive defect, but it won't make it that easy, right? So if they give you a question about a boy that presents with a genetic mutation, and then they ask like a non-specific question about like the most likely pathogenesis of this person's disease, what do you want to think about? You want to think about an enzyme defect, right? Now, what is the mechanism of disease in a 25-year-old, 6-foot male that, you know, is infertile, has a micropenis? Well, that's genetic non-disjunction, right? Remember, you're thinking about Klinefelter's with this. Now, what's the most common cause of death between the ages of 1 month to 1 year? That's actually SIDS, right? So like sudden infant death syndrome. Between the ages of 1 to 44 years, you want to think more about like motor vehicle accidents. Now, what is the most common cause of blindness in the elderly? That's actually macular degeneration, right? Now, what's the most common valvular abnormality in the elderly? That's aortic stenosis. Now, what is the most important risk factor for the development of pressure ulcers? So this is actually when a person has, they may even ask this as a mechanism question. It's actually when you have like increased pressure on capillaries. And remember that pressure ulcers don't just arise like in the, like this. You don't only have like sacral decubitus ulcers. You can also have it behind the occiput, right? Because again, right, basically any place where you chronically can put pressure on like that part of the body, that can develop like a pressure ulcer pretty much. Now, what's the most common cause of anemia in an alcoholic? It's actually anemia of chronic disease. Your friends at the MBMA, they will try to trick you into picking megaloblastic anemia. Don't do that, right? The most common cause of anemia in an alcoholic, believe it or not, is anemia of chronic disease. Now, what's the most common cause of thrombocytopenia in the healthcare setting? That's actually the use of heparin, right? Now, what's the most common cause of hypertension in a young reproductive age female? That'll be OCP use, right? She stops the OCP use, hypertension goes away. Now, what's the most common cause of death in a patient that's struck by lightning? That's actually cardiorespiratory arrest, right? And remember that in these people, right, if they were to have like a shoulder dislocation, it'll be a posterior shoulder dislocation. Now, in a patient that's exposed to radiation, what is the most likely neoplastic complication? So in a patient exposed to radiation, what is the most likely neoplastic complication? Well, that will actually be acute leukemia, right? They will try to trick you on the exam into picking like papillary thyroid cancer. Don't do that, right? The most likely neoplastic, or you can say malignant complication of exposure to radiation is acute leukemia, right? But don't, make sure you separate this from another concept in your mind, right? I mean, overall, the biggest risk factor for papillary thyroid cancer is exposure to radiation, but it's radiation like in the head and neck, okay? And then another bizarre question you may see on your test is, what is the most damaging radiation to the skin? Is it UVA radiation or UVB radiation? It's actually UVB, okay? Now, what's the most serious complication in a young female that, you know, has like a BMI of 15? Or obviously, this person has anorexia nervosa. You can even extend this thought to a person with bulimia nervosa. What's the most serious complication that can develop in these patients? Well, that's actually a ventricular arrhythmia from hypokalemia, right? Because typically these people tend to use laxatives and get hypokalemia with that. Now, in a hospitalized patient, what is the most common cause of vitamin K deficiency? So this is actually from the use of antibiotics, right? That essentially kills off all the flora in the colon. And then what's the most likely side of, like if a person has like a bone met from a malignancy, what is the most likely bone to have mets? Well, that's actually the vertebral column, right? And remember this, if they ask you about the mechanism behind this, think about like the Batson vertebral plexus as being the mechanism. It's just a plexus that drains many organs, but somehow bypasses the vertebral bodies and spinal cord and whatnot. Now, here's one nifty question your friends at the MBME love. What if you have a patient, you know, has like a malignancy that is metastatic to like the vertebral bodies to like, you know, like bone pretty much. And then they ask, what is the most likely primary malignancy that gives rise to this metastasis? You want to think about breast cancer. Breast cancer is the number one cause of bone mets, right? The second most common cause is prostate cancer, okay? Although overall, remember that prostate cancer is the most common cancer that produces osteoblastic metastasis, okay? But overall, the most common cancer, like if they show you like an image of a person, like a bone scan, having like a ton of bone mets, and they ask for the most likely primary malignancy, that's going to be breast cancer. Now, and then one other thing the NBME loves is, what if they tell you that, oh, you know, you find some kind of metastatic malignancy somewhere? What is the most likely primary site of malignancy? Maybe I should take a small step back here. Let's maybe break this down, right? So I said that if a person has bone mets, the most likely primary is breast cancer. Well, another high yield thing to know is if a person has liver mets, the most likely primary is actually going to be lung cancer. They'll try to trick you into picking colon cancer. I mean, the most common site of colon cancer metastasis is to the liver. But if you see metastatic disease in the liver, it usually arises from the lungs. Remember, your L's match liver. So if a person has liver mets, the most likely primary is lung cancer. If a person has brain mets, the most common primary is lung cancer as well. Okay? Lung cancer loves to metastasize to brain. Now, if a person has lung mets, right, the person will have, like, the most likely primary is going to be breast cancer. I mean, the breast is kind of in the same general area. Those are very high yield things to know, I promise you. Now, what is a future malignancy that may develop in a person that has a history of retinoblastoma? Well, that's osteosarcoma, right? Remember, that's like an RB gene mutation. And then, what is the most common mutation overall that gives rise to malignancy? That's actually having a P53 mutation, right? And then, what's the most common valvular complication of Marfan syndrome? That's actually mitral valve prolapse, right? Again, don't forget your mitral valve prolapse with myxomatous cell valvular degeneration. Now, what's the most common neoplastic complication of having HIV infection? That's actually Kaposi sarcoma, right? Now, in a patient, you know, that's admitted to like a hospital in the US, and this patient is over the age of 65, what is the most likely diagnosis on admission? That's actually CHF, right? I mean, like, essentially for like a CHF exacerbation. And then if you have a patient presenting to the hospital and they ultimately receive like a final diagnosis of rheumatic fever, what is the most likely present, like, what's the most likely initial clinical presentation? That'll be a migratory polyarthritis, okay? Now, what is the most common mutation that gives, like, on what chromosome would you have like the most common mutation that gives rise to like hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy? That'll be actually on chromosome 11. Okay. Now, if, let's assume you get a question about like, you know, 55-year-old male presenting with a hemoglobin of 8, MCV of 60, the most likely finding on further evaluation of this patient? Well, that'll actually be the discovery of like, you know, like polyps or like colorectal cancer when you perform a colonoscopy. Okay. Now, what is the most serious complication of sickle cell disease? The most serious complication of sickle cell disease? That's actually like something called acute chest syndrome, right? You know, classically the presentation of that will be like, you know, like chest pain. You'll have like all these lung symptoms, like a new pleural effusion. And actually, believe it or not, this is actually the most common cause of death in young folks with a sickle cell disease. It's typically from acute chest syndrome. Okay. Now, what's the most likely trigger of a hemolytic episode in a patient with G6PD deficiency? That'll actually be acute infection. Okay. Now, if you have a patient that has some kind of disorder of platelet dysfunction, what is the most likely clinical presenting complaint? This will actually be nosebleeds, right? Remember, nosebleeds generally happen because you have like the Kieselback plexus in the nose, right? That's actually a high yield factoid to know for many exams. Now, what's the most likely infectious complication of receiving a blood transfusion? What is the most likely infectious complication of receiving a blood transfusion? That's actually CMV infection. They'll try to trick you on the exam into choosing Hep C. Don't choose Hep C. It's going to be CMV. Now, what's the most common infectious precipitant of an acute COPD exacerbation? This is actually H-flu, Haemophilus influenza, right? The thing is, one other way they may actually test this thing is, they may give you like a pneumonia question in a patient that's, you know, having like an acute COPD exacerbation, and then they'll give you multiple bugs, and then they won't really give you much in the way of clues in the question. If you see like pneumonia, for example, in a COPD patient, like a patient, again, coming in with a COPD exacerbation, think about Haemophilus influenza as like the most likely cause. Now, what is the most likely clinical complication of Barrett's esophagus? It's actually the formation of esophageal ulcers, right? With like strictures, right? And that will ultimately cause dysphagia, right? Because the person will have like literal physical obstructions to movement of a food through the esophagus. Now, what is the most common cause of death in a patient with cirrhosis? So this is actually the rupture of esophageal varices, right? And then if you get a question about a patient that has like a bleeding gastric ulcer, and then they ask you what's the most likely vessel to be involved, that'll actually be like the left gastric artery, right? If a patient has like a bleeding duodenal ulcer and they ask you the most likely vessel to be involved, or they give you a question about a patient that has like a bleeding duodenal ulcer and the patient like dies from profound blood loss, think about erosion of the gastroduodenal artery, right? This thing is very life-threatening, really, really bad. I mean, I've literally had people have this problem, and it's not pretty when it happens, trust me. Okay, now, I've kind of mentioned this already, right? But if a person has colon cancer, what's the most likely place colon cancer metastasizes to, right? That's going to be the liver. Okay, but again, remember, if you see liver mets, the most common cause of liver mets is lung cancer, okay? It's just like the most likely primary cancer that gives rise to liver mets is lung cancer, right? And another thing your friends at the MBME may do is, like, let me maybe put it this way. A nice easy way to differentiate between a primary malignancy in an organ and metastatic disease is just look at how many lesions there are. If there's just one lesion, it's probably a primary malignancy. If there's multiple lesions, it's probably going to be a metastatic malignancy. It's probably going to be mets to that organ. Now, what is the most common cause of cirrhosis in a kid? It's actually alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Okay. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for having a hepatic adenoma? So that's actually the use of OCPs. What's the biggest risk factor for liver angiosarcoma? That's actually exposure to vinyl chloride, right? I mean, like, liver angiosarcoma is awful, awful, awful. I think life expectancy is what, like 6 months or something like that. Okay. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for cholangiocarcinoma in the U.S.? That's actually PSC, right? Primary sclerosing cholangitis. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for chronic pancreatitis in a child? That's actually cystic fibrosis, right? Now, what is the biggest risk factor for pancreatic adenocarcinoma? That's actually smoking, right? Now, what is the biggest risk factor for end-stage renal disease in the U.S.? That's actually diabetes, okay? Now, what is the most likely renal complication associated with using an aminoglycoside? That's actually acute tubular necrosis. Now, what is the most likely renal complication associated with sickle cell disease? That's actually asymptomatic hematuria, okay? Now, in a patient, you know, that has like a nephrolithiasis, like a renal calculus, I guess I'll just tell you this, right? So typically these people have like normal blood calcium levels, but they will have high urinary calcium. So they are normal calcemic and hypercalciuric. Now, what is the most likely complication of, at least on exams, what is the most likely complication of VHL? So like von Hippel-Lindau, what is the most likely complication? This is actually bilateral renal cell carcinoma. I mean, it happens in what, like 50 to 60% of patients with VHL? And please, 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 don't forget the association of VHL with things like hemangioblastoma, right? Classically, that'll produce like high levels of EPO, right? And they can have these hemangioblastomas in the cerebellum. They can also have like retinal hemangioblastomas. And remember that, right? VHL, autosomal dominant inheritance, it's on chromosome 3, right? And one thing your friends at the MBME may ask you is like, what kind of screening should you do in these people? Well, these people actually need like annual retinal exams, right? You want to check for those retinal hemangioblastomas. These people also need like annual ultrasounds, right? Because you want to assess for like renal cell, the bilateral renal cell carcinomas. If you actually read some literature, it actually kind of also shows that you may want to get like annual metanephrine levels, because you want to assess for pheos, right? Remember, pheochromocytomas are actually common in VHL, right? And then these people, for the most part, they also need like brain and spine MRIs like every 2 years. Again, you want to check for that hemangioblastoma, right? And then they will also need like audiological screening as well every 2 to 3 years. You may say, Divine, this stuff sounds really low yield. I promise you it's not low yield. Okay. Now, in a patient that, you know, presents with flank pain relating to the groin, right? So like essentially like a kidney stone, what is the most likely site of obstruction? That's the ureters, right? Sometimes some literature may say like the ureterovesical junction, right? Like the UVJ. So I'll just tell you this. They will either put ureter as your answer or UVJ as your answer, right? Now, what is the biggest risk factor for sepsis in a hospitalized patient? That's actually the presence of an indwelling urinary catheter, right? In fact, the most common cause of sepsis in a hospitalized patient for the most part is E. coli. Now, in a patient that ultimately is diagnosed with bladder cancer, what is the most likely initial presenting complaint? So that'll be like painless or, you know, like gross hematuria. Now, in a child that presents with scrotal enlargement, what is the most likely additional finding on further examination and testing? That'll be a hydrocele, right? Now, what is the biggest risk factor for impotence in a patient that's greater than 50 years old? That's actually vascular insufficiency, okay? Now, in a woman that presents with like dysmenorrhea, dyspareunia, dyschezia, right? Obviously endometriosis. Remember, sometimes they may put like nodularity of the uterosacral ligament on exam. What is the most likely mechanism underlying these findings? So this is actually like reverse menstruation. So reverse menses through the fallopian tubes. They love to test this on NBM exams. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for female infertility? And I guess ectopic pregnancy. What is the biggest risk factor? That's actually PID, right? In fact, the biggest risk factor for ectopic pregnancy is scarring from a prior PID, okay? And what if they give you like a question about like the most common ovarian mass in a patient that's pregnant? That's actually a corpus luteum cyst, right? Okay. Now, what is the most likely underlying mechanism behind the high prevalence of breast cancer being diagnosed like in the upper outer quadrant of the breast? Well, it's because you just have an increased density of breast tissue, right, in that region, right, in the upper outer quadrant. Now, what is the most serious complication of acromegaly? It's actually death from dilated cardiomyopathy. Okay. Now, what is the most likely clinical presentation in a patient that's ultimately diagnosed with primary hyperparathyroidism? That's actually nephrolithiasis, right? Now, what is the biggest risk factor for hyperphosphatemia? So high levels of phosphate. That's easy, right? That's chronic renal failure. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for peripheral neuropathy in the US? That's actually diabetes, right? Now, what is the biggest risk factor for fasting hypoglycemia in the US? The biggest risk factor for fasting hypoglycemia. That's actually alcoholism. Remember, alcoholics, if you want to really dig deep or if you're interested, you can send me an email. I'll try to explain. But it's something involving like having high levels of NADH. It's something you can actually prove biochemically. Or I mean reasonable biochemically. Okay. Now, what is the most likely clinical presentation, right? So like, what's the most likely like initial clinical presenting complaint in a patient that's ultimately diagnosed with Paget's disease? Well, that's bone pain, right? And remember, Paget's disease, you made the diagnosis with a bone scan. They usually have maybe like an elevated ALK phos. Remember that it increases the risk of osteosarcoma. And remember that you treat it with a bisphosphonate. Okay. Now, what is the most serious complication of tetanus? So that's actually like pneumonia and like cardiac arrest. Pretty bad, right? Now, what is the most likely clinical presentation in a patient that is ultimately diagnosed with myasthenia gravis? That will actually be ptosis, right? Now, what's the most common cause of impetigo? That's easy, right? That's Staph aureus. Now, what's the most common presentation of like a superficial dermatophytosis? Like, what's the most common tinea, pretty much? Well, that'll be tinea pedis, right? Like Achilles foot. And one tidbit, I guess, let me just take a quick sidebar here. If a person has like nail fungus, right, like tinea unguium, you want to treat it with an oral agent, right, like oral terbinafine. If you don't see oral terbinafine, you can pick itraconazole. They will try to trick you into giving like a topical agent. Don't give a topical agent for tinea, like nail fungus, and also for tinea capitis. Tinea capitis does not respond to topical agents. For those you treat with oral agents. You can use like oral terbinafine, stuff like that. That'll be like tinea capitis, right? Now, what is the most common cause of non-communicating hydrocephalus in a newborn? It's actually like a stricture or obstruction in the like the cerebral aqueduct of Sylvius. Now, in a patient that's presenting with any kind of CNS infection, what is the most likely underlying mechanism of disease? Well, that will actually be hematogenous spread. Most infections that get to the CNS, they get there through the bloodstream. Now, what are the two biggest risk factors for carpal tunnel syndrome? That's actually pregnancy and rheumatoid arthritis. Okay. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for optic neuritis? That's multiple sclerosis. Okay. Now, what is the most common cause of blindness in a patient with HIV? That's actually CMV retinitis, right? Okay. Now, what is a favorable prognostic factor in an individual, you know, usually like a kid that has ALL? That's actually the presence of like a 1221 translocation. Now, what is the most important determinant of prognosis in a patient that has Hodgkin's lymphoma? It's actually the clinical stage of disease. It's actually not the type of Hodgkin's lymphoma that determines our prognosis. Okay. They like to trick people with this stuff on exams, right? Because for the most part, if you have just like lymphadenopathy above the diaphragm, that's actually, you know, pretty good prognosis associated with that. Okay. Now, one other thing that your friends at the MBME kind of expect you to know is like Ramsden's criteria for pancreatitis. So I'll just take a small sidebar. There's like criteria you think of on admission, and then criteria you think of like 48 hours after admission, because they can easily make this into like a prognosis question on your test, right? So for criteria on admission, you want to think about the mnemonic GA law, right? So like Georgia law, right? So like the G stands for like glucose greater than 100. The A is AST greater than 250. The L is LDH greater than 350. The other A is age greater than 55, right? And then the W is a white count greater than 16,000, right? And then 2 days after admission, right? So like 48 hours of post-admission, you want to think about Calvin and Hobbes, right? So like C and Hobbes. The H is for like hematocrit dropping by greater than 10%. The O is for like O2 sats less than 60 millimeters of mercury, right? The first B is like a BUN increase on admission, right? So like a BUN increase greater than 5 mg per deciliter. The other B is like a base deficit greater than 4 mg per deciliter, right? And then the S is like, you know, like needing more than like 6 liters of fluid, I think. Yeah, needing more than 6 liters of fluid within a 48 hour period. And then the C is just having a hypocalcemia, right? So like a calcium less than like 8 mg per deciliter. So that's something you definitely want to make sure you know for exams. Very, very high yield to know that stuff. To know that stuff for exams. Okay. Now, what is the most important prognostic factor in a patient with renal cell carcinoma? Or what's the most likely, like, most important factor that's determinant of prognosis? Well, that's actually invasion of the renal vein, right? Now, what is the most important prognostic factor in a patient that presents with melanoma? It's actually the depth of invasion, right? Now, some fancy stuff that your friends at the MBME want you to know about NF2, right, is you want to know that these people tend to require, like, you know, like, regular hearing screening, right? Remember, like, they can have acoustic neuromas. And they also typically need, like, annual brain MRIs, right? Typically from, like, age 10 to, like, the fourth decade of life. And remember, right, NF2, chromosome 22 mutation, right? And these people also, I guess this is also kind of bleeding into NF1. At least an NF1 person, you want them to also have, like, routine ophthalmologic screening, right? You want to screen for those optic nerve gliomas, right? Now, another general thing you want to keep in mind for exams are like, you know, like just common complications of Sturge-Weber syndrome, right? So like, remember Sturge-Weber syndrome usually presents as like a port wine stain, like in a trigeminal nerve distribution. These people tend to have like seizures, developmental delay. They can have like hemiparesis, right? Because they can have all these capillary malformations. Now, what if they give you a question about a child that has like, you know, multiple bone metastases? And then they ask you, what's the most likely primary malignancy? Well, you want to think about neuroblastoma. Okay, if you don't see neuroblastoma as an answer, you know, pick between like rhabdomyosarcoma or like a Wilms tumor. Now, what is the most likely reproductive complication of receiving systemic chemotherapy? That's actually hypogonadism, right? Now, what is the biggest risk factor for uterine sarcoma? That's actually radiation therapy to the pelvis, right? Now, what is the mechanism behind like increased insulin resistance in a pregnant female? That's actually the presence of human placental lactogen, right? Like HPL. Okay. Now, one thing I guess I want to say is, again, this is like an ethics-related thing you see on an exam. But if they give you a question about a person, you know, that's about to die and their family comes in for like a visit or something like that, right? You don't just jump in and start asking them a bunch of like closed-ended questions. You start with like an open-ended question where you ask them like, how much do you know or how much do you want to know? Like, what do you understand about what's going on, right? So generally in ethics questions, you want to pick the answer that encourages more conversation between the patient and physician, right? Or between the family and physician. But again, you want to start open-ended first. I mean, this is like a nice rule for step 2 CS as well. You start with open-ended questions before you jump into closed-ended questions. Closed-ended questions are, for the most part, used to fill in blanks you have from asking your initial open-ended questions. Okay, now, what is the most common complication of a ganglion cyst resection? That's actually recurrence, right? Now, one quick sidebar I want to take is like having an idea about like diabetes and its like bad infections. So people with diabetes, they tend to have like really nasty infections. Like they may have like an infection that is common, but they tend to develop like a nasty complication, right? So for example, you know, many people get cellulitis in the perineal area, not a big deal. But the thing is, diabetics, for whatever reason, that perineal cellulitis can then move on to becoming like neck fasc, right? Where they have like funnies, gangrene, essentially, right? Occasionally, you may also see a question about like, you know, like a diabetic, you know, they have like pyelonephritis, you know, flank pain, CV tenderness, fever. And then, you know, you give them antibiotics. So, you know, you give them like IV ceftriaxone. And then they don't seem to be getting better. And then they ask for your next best step in management. You actually want to go ahead and obtain a repeat CT scan because those people have likely developed some kind of complication of pyelonephritis, right? So they may have something called like a perinephric abscess, which you have to, you know, do an incision and drainage. Or they may have something called like emphysematous pyelonephritis, where you have like gas bubbles in the wall of the kidneys, right? And remember, funny is gangrene, right? Because it's a kind of neck fash, you need to do debridement, right? And typically you also need to, you know, give broad spectrum antibiotics, although those antibiotics also need to include a clindamycin. In general, if a person ever has neck fash, you always need to include clindamycin in their drug regimen, or pick the answer that includes clindamycin as part of the regimen, because the clindamycin will help with like the toxin production, right? Remember, clindamycin is a protein synthesis inhibitor. It's a ribosomal, anti-ribosomal agent. And then if they give you a question about like a diabetic, you know, that has like right upper quadrant pain, they may not just have like regular cholecystitis, they may have something called gangrenous cholecystitis, right? Where again, you see like gas bubbles in the walls of the gallbladder. Those people need like an emergent cholecystectomy, right? And then a person that has diabetes, right? Like if they present with like sinusitis, facial pain, I would hope under those circumstances you're thinking about mucormycosis, right? Caused by like a rhizopus species. And typically for that, right, you give amphotericin B and debride extensively and then pray for the best, right? Many people don't survive that stuff. And then otitis externa, right? Again, ear pain, debris, blah, 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 right? Otitis externa, very common in diabetics, right? And remember, the most common cause of otitis externa is Pseudomonas aeruginosa, right? But remember that diabetics, they can actually develop something called a necrotizing otitis externa, right? So again, just big things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams with diabetics. And this is just a clinical pearl. If you're treating a diabetic that has infection, better keep your eyes peeled wide open because they can go from doing really well to crashing and burning in front of you real quick. Okay, now, what is the most common pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor in a patient that has a history of MEN1? That's actually a gastrinoma, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has cardiac amyloidosis and then they say what's the most likely finding on an EKG? That's actually like low voltage, right? Just low voltage on an EKG. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for mitral regurgitation? Oh, sure many people have not thought about this. That's a free mitral valve prolapse. The biggest risk factor for mitral regurg is mitral valve prolapse. Now, what's the most common cause of folliculitis? That'll be staph aureus. Okay. Now, in a dark complexioned patient that's presenting with a melanoma, what's the most likely subtype of melanoma this person has? That's actually something called like the acral-lentiginous melanoma. Remember, the most common kind of melanoma, I'm fairly certain about this, is like the superficial spreading type. But if you see a person that's, you know, black basically and has a melanoma, you want to think about the acral-lentiginous kind. Now, in a patient that's presenting with erythema multiforme, what is the most likely inciting factor giving rise to disease? That's actually like a recurrent, like a recurrence of like a herpes simplex virus infection, right? But don't confuse this with like Stevens-Johnson syndrome or like toxic epidermal necrolysis. The most likely inciting agent is like a, some kind of drug, okay? Like antibiotics, allopurinol, stuff like that. Now, what is the most likely mechanism of disease in a patient that's presenting with signs and symptoms of hypopituitarism? That's actually a pituitary adenoma that's compressing the, like the normal pituitary gland, okay? Now, if you have a hospitalized patient that, you know, is presenting on like stones, bones, groans, psychic overtones, what is the most likely finding on further clinical evaluation? So in a hospitalized patient, that'll actually be malignancy, right? Remember, the most common cause of hypercalcemia in a hospital setting is malignancy. If you have an outpatient setting, you're thinking more about like primary hyperparathyroidism. Now, in a patient that has like a history of MEN1, what is the most likely symptom that will trigger like initial presentation to the healthcare system? That's actually signs and symptoms of hypercalcemia, right? The most likely presentation in MEN1 is hypercalcemia. Most likely clinical presentation in MEN2 is actually medullary thyroid cancer, believe it or not. Now, what is the most common infectious cause of odynophagia? So not dysphagia, odynophagia, like painful swallowing. That's actually C. albicans, right? Candida albicans. Remember, candida, right? You can treat it with like nice, basically anything that can coat that badness will fix the problem, right? Like nystatin switch and swallow, an antifungal like lozenge or something like that. Those things can all work for C. albicans. Now, if a patient, let's say, you get a question about a patient, has severe abdominal pain radiating to the back. And then they say, so obviously this person has acute pancreatitis, right? And then they say, within the next few days, 2 weeks, what is the most likely complication that this patient is going to develop? That's actually a pancreatic pseudocyst, okay? The most common complication of acute pancreatitis is a pancreatic pseudocyst. Now, what is the most common cause of osmotic diarrhea? That's actually lactase deficiency, right? Now, what is the most likely mechanism behind, I don't know, like treatment failure in a patient that's placed on a gluten-free diet for celiac disease? That's actually non-adherence, right? It's very hard for people to adhere to a specific diet. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? You know, this patient, they tell you that, oh, this patient is noted to have like abnormal LFTs on like routine screening labs. What is the most likely etiology of these abnormal LFTs? That's actually like any FLD, right? So like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Now, in a patient that's less than 45 presenting with knee pain, what's the most likely etiology? Less than 45 years old. Well, that's patellofemoral pain syndrome, right? And then there's this question that I know for whatever reason a lot of people get wrong. If a patient has like pain like at the inferior heel, what's the most likely cause on exams? That's plantar fasciitis, right? That's easy peasy. Now, of the three main causes of vaginitis, which one is sexually transmitted? So between like Candida, Trichomonas, and Gardnerella vaginalis, which one is sexually transmitted? That's actually just Trichomonas. Now, in a patient that's getting a blood transfusion, what is the most serious complication that may develop within the next, 6 to 12 hours? That's actually something called, you can remember it as TACO, right? So like transfusion-associated circulatory overload, right? And usually people that have like kidney disease, like pre-existing kidney disease, liver disease, they tend to be kidney disease or heart disease, they tend to be at very high risk for this. Now, what is the most common reported STI in the US? That's going to be chlamydia, right? And then what if you get a question about a patient in the military, right, that's presenting with anthrax? What is the most likely clinical presentation? It'll actually just be cutaneous anthrax, right? They were trying to trick you into picking like pulmonary anthrax. I mean, pulmonary anthrax is something that can happen as a result of anthrax, right? But you want to think more about cutaneous anthrax. That's the most likely clinical presentation. Remember, anthrax is one of those things that can also cause like a widened mediastinum on imaging, okay, from the hemorrhagic mediastinitis. And if you get a question about a person that's from Hawaii and you have like some like conjunctival injection, blah, 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 what bug are you thinking about? Well, that'll be leptospirosis, right, from like Leptospira interrogans. Now, what is the most common cause of for pneumothorax in a HIV-positive patient? That would actually be infection with a pneumocystis jirovetsi, okay? Now, if you have a patient that's, you know, diagnosed with, like, the flu, right? Remember, the flu is caused by the influenza virus, not Haemophilus influenza, right? So you have a patient diagnosed with the flu, what is the most likely near-term complication? So the thing is, if you get this kind of question, you want to pick one of two things on your exam, right? They either have the most likely like complication is either like a primary influenza pneumonia, or they may have like a secondary like bacterial superinfection. Okay, that's probably the one that's more commonly seen on exams. Now, what's the most common cause of diabetes insipidus? That's actually the use of lithium. Okay. Now, what is the most common cause of nephrotic syndrome in African Americans? That's FSGS, right? That's easy. What's the most common cause of nephrotic syndrome in Caucasians or white people, pretty much? That's membranous nephropathy, right? Sometimes, instead of putting membranous nephropathy, they may put membranous glomerulopathy on your test, right? And then remember, the most common cause of nephrotic syndrome in kids is minimal chain disease, right? That's easy. Now, what is the most serious extrarenal complication of ADPKD? So autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease. So most serious extrarenal complication of ADPKD. Well, that'll actually be the rupture of an intracranial like cerebral aneurysm. Okay. Now, what's the most common malignancy that develops in a kidney transplant recipient? That'll be actually be like cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. Okay. Now, what's the most likely mechanism of disease in a patient that presents with like status epilepticus? Most likely mechanism of disease. That's actually from having like a low level of their anti-epileptic drug. Okay. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for intracerebral hemorrhage? That's hypertension, right? Now, what is the most common cause of rapidly progressive dementia? That's CJD, right? Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Remember, these people tend to have like myoclonus, and then they'll have like elevated levels of the protein 1433 in their CSF. Now, in a patient that's ultimately diagnosed with cervical cancer, what is the most common initial healthcare system? Most common initial healthcare system presentation. Well, you want to think about like abnormal vaginal bleeding. You think that, oh, this abnormal vaginal bleeding just applies to endometrial cancer. Believe it or not, it also applies to cervical cancer. Now, what's the most common anterior mediastinal mass? That's a thymoma, right? What's the most common middle mediastinal mass? That's actually just lymphadenopathy. Now, what's the most common posterior mediastinal mass? That'll be some kind of neurogenic tumor, right? If you want to be a little more specific, you want to think more along the lines of a schwannoma, okay? Now, if a patient has like nausea, let me just maybe tell you this as a factoid. If you have a patient that, you know, is like nauseous, vomiting, can't protect their airway, you never want to place those patients on like BiPAP or CPAP. That's just an important factoid to know for exams, right? Now, what is the most common extra-articular manifestation of ankylosing spondylitis? That's actually anterior uveitis, right? And then what's the lupus antibody that has the strongest association with kidney disease? Those are actually the anti-double-stranded DNA antibodies, okay? And then my final question here. What is the most, if you have a patient that, you know, presents with a relapse, like, you know, ultimately diagnosed with relapsing polychondritis, what is the most common presentation to the healthcare system? That's actually the patient will be complaining of like a red hot, painful ear. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step one, step two CK, step three, step two CS, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, like the ABIM boards, I tutor for those. If you're a college student, I tutor for Gen Chem, O Chem, physics, biochem, histology, physiology, the works. And then I also offer like some courses, right? So like I do like this, essentially it's like a crash course for step one, it's 20 hours. Step two, CK, step three, it's 10 hours each. Obviously I can do longer if you want. just kind of depends on your needs. Basically, like, it's something that I do when people are at the end of their dedicated periods and they want to solidify everything together really quick, or when people are, you know, they feel like their knowledge base is pretty good and again they just want to solidify things really fast. That's something I offer. Like, many people have done this where they've been like very successful with that. So if that's something you're interested in, just reach out to me either through the website or you send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And then there's also this thing I've started offering like recently that a lot of people have actually taken advantage of and found to be useful. And it's something that I call like a repair. It's almost like a repair course, right? A repair course. And basically, what do I mean by a repair course? So typically when you take these MBME exams, right, you know, they'll show you like all these bars that tells you that you're weak in a certain area. Like, oh, you're weak in cardiology. You're weak in this. You're weak in that. You're weak in this. You're weak in that. Typically with these repair courses, it usually goes for like 2 to 3 hours. And basically, if you have like a specific weakness, like a subject weakness, like, oh, cardio is my weakness, GI is my weakness, reach out to me with an email. And that's something that's very fixable. Like, many times it's almost like, or it's almost like clockwork. I've worked with people where like cardiology will be like, there'll be like, it'll be like a very left leaning bar in their MBMEs. And then we have like this repair course, 2 hours, they take another practice exam and cardio is like very right leaning bar. So if that's like a specific need you have, feel free to reach out to me. And then, like I've said earlier, if you know you need like a very comprehensive like USMLE course for any of the USMLE exams, if you have a group of 5 people or more, again, just send me an email and we can work out the details of that. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, right? I do offer like, you know, like one-on-one, I guess, coaching, like mock interviews, personal statement, editing, rec letters, editing applications, stuff like that. So again, I've worked with tons of people. They've done really well. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I do hope that you've gotten something from this podcast. This is a very high yield podcast for sure to know for step 2 CK and step 3. So I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.